The title of this lecture is Introduction to Religion. We're going to look at the world's religions in later lectures, but immediately with that word, we land ourselves in difficulties. Like all words which relate to human experience and accomplishments, such as art or education, philosophy, politics, religion doesn't lend itself to any kind of simplistic definition. It can, of course, mean a particular system of belief or worship, such as Judaism, Buddhism, or Christianity. But if that were the whole story, it would be a relatively simple matter to get a picture of what religion means. One would merely have to describe how each religion operates, outline its beliefs and practices, perhaps compare and contrast one with another, and emerge with a reasonably comprehensive outline of religions as we observe them. But this is only one meaning of religion, and perhaps not the most important, because religion isn't just a system, but a personal experience involving some kind of commitment. As Carl Gustav Jung, the psychologist, wrote, "So long as religion is only faith and outward form, and the religious function is not experienced in our own souls, nothing of any importance has happened." Of course, that begs the question, which we shall look at in a later lecture, of the meaning of this ambiguous word soul. But Jung is giving a clear signpost. Religion is personal. It is within us, consciously or otherwise. The word itself is derived from the Latin word religio, of which the adjective is religiosus. But even that doesn't help, because what is that word connected with? The link is often made with religare, meaning to bind. But that too is ambiguous. Bound to what? Bound to whom? One could say that anything to which a person is bound will play a dominant role in his or her life. Thus, the pursuit of learning could be one man's religion, and numerous scholars might well agree with him. But by the same token, the cultivation of idleness could be another's. For some, it is the desire to pass our days in peace and quietness, as the prayer book puts it. Others prefer the whiff of battle in their nostrils, another mountain to climb, a new cause to champion. For countless members of the human race, if that is our definition, football is then a religion. Sex is a religion. Helping the poor and the distressed is a religion. War is a religion. Making money is a religion. Anything, in fact, which a person thinks about most in his or her spare time. Clearly, whatever definition or definitions of religion we settle for, it can be taken as a factor that plays at least a compelling part in the life of anyone who pursues it, and perhaps an all-absorbing one. It would be a little bit odd, wouldn't it, for someone to say, "Music is my religion, but I hardly ever listen to it," or "Alcohol is my religion, but I only drink on Saturday nights." Is it enough to content ourselves with this loose, even shapeless, definition? If all obsessions, enthusiasms, areas of deep personal commitment constitute a person's religion, why have the word at all? Wouldn't we be wiser, if only for the sake of linguistic accuracy, to dispense with it altogether? This was proposed by W.C. Smith in 1964 in The Meaning and End of Religion. He was writing while the Honest to God controversy was raging. That was a book written by the Bishop of Woolwich, suggesting we've got to change our whole idea about God. This might offer the relief of a reprieve, but I think the respite would be brief. The fact is that a fair percentage of the human race accept, without necessarily being able to express it in words, certainly not words which would satisfy an analytically trained scholar, they accept that there is a distinction to be made between the religious experience and the experiences that accrue from the enthusiastic pursuit of pleasurable activities. Even Smith exempted personal piety from his list of activities and qualities from which he wished to exclude the idea of religion. But piety will hardly do, since it simply raises further questions with regard to its nature, its manifestation, and above all, its direction. With what, to return to Religare, is piety bound? It will show itself in the exercise of self-control. The Greek word is enkrataia, meaning literally making oneself thin or holding oneself in, which would appear to exclude from the arena of religion anyone who has a lust for life. This seems at the very least anti-Darwinian, alien to the survival instinct, which Darwin suggested was and remains the predominant factor in the lives of all sentient beings. It may help to look at some of the characteristics of religion which have been handed down to us. It won't tell us precisely what it is to be religious, but it should help to shed some light on what Ovid termed, that's the Roman poet Ovid, he called it the rough and disorderly mass. And I take this list of characteristics of religion, it's just one out of a large number to be found, but it's written by W.P. Alston in his book Philosophy of Language. Now, he makes 9 suggestions as to what it is that constitutes a religion. Doesn't say all are necessary, but he says that some of these will be found in any religion. First of all, belief in supernatural beings, or gods. Secondly, a distinction between sacred and profane objects. Thirdly, ritual acts focused around sacred objects. Fourthly, a moral code believed to be sanctioned by the gods. Fifthly, characteristically religious feelings. And he gives the examples of awe, sense of mystery, sense of guilt, adoration, and so on, which tend to be aroused in the presence of sacred objects and during the practice of ritual, and which are associated with the gods. Six, prayer and other forms of communication with gods. Seven, a world view, that is, a general picture of the world as a whole and of the place of the individual in it, including a specification of its overall significance. Alston presumably includes in this characteristic a belief in some kind of continuing existence after the end of this life, or in Hindu terminology, this cycle of experience. 8. A more or less total organization of one's life based on the world view. 9. A social organization bound together by these preceding characteristics. Now that's Alston's 9. I'd like to add another one, it's along similar lines, so, and it brings it up to a round number as well. 10. The acceptance of certain texts as being supernaturally inspired, so that they bring out the distinction made in the second of those between sacred and profane objects. They can be seen as the main source of the knowledge of the moral code in the fourth one. They are read publicly in the third one during the ritual acts, and privately as an expression of one's prayer and communication with gods. So I would want to add that 10th one. Now, 2 points can be made immediately. Firstly, some of the world religions either treat as unimportant or disregard entirely some of these characteristics. Only the theistic religions, and that will come out in a later lecture, the meaning there, but the main theistic religions in chronological order of their appearance in the world are Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Only these accept that there is a connection between how I feel I ought to behave, that's the fourth point we were talking about, and obeying the will of God. That there's a link, in other words, between my sense of right and wrong and my sense that this is what God is commanding me. In India, Jainism and Buddhism, particularly in its original Theravada expression, which we shall look at in a later lecture, in Jainism and Buddhism, and in China, in Taoism and Confucianism, they all reject the idea of God And with it, much of what is included under the fifth one, characteristic religious feelings, together with the distinction between sacred and profane objects. This is a point of view shared by arguably the most religiously advanced, though of course that's a value judgment, but we will look at again in a later lecture, the most religiously advanced system in Hinduism, which is Advaita Vedanta. Though teaching that the union between the self, which they call the Atman, and the ground of being, which is the Brahman, is the moment of enlightenment, Vedanta does not view this as a supernatural experience, but rather as the end of all human endeavor, and therefore sees it as a thoroughly natural, even though not universally experienced, at any rate not in this life, as a purely natural happening. Of course, the word supernatural is another of those vague terms which we may have to analyze eventually. Zen Buddhists and among Christians, Quakers and Salvation Armyists have only a modicum of ritual in their religious activities. And numerous hermits, mystics, and other contemplatives over the centuries have had little to do with any social organization, in fact, often being treated with suspicion by those who do. It seems that the manifestation of the characteristics which Alston outlines has been a pick-and-mix affair so far as the world's religions are concerned. The second area of discussion arising from the list springs from the fact that a very large number of people belong to organizations which would normally be categorized under the umbrella of secular, worldly, rather than religious, yet still show many of the characteristics that Alston describes. These include bodies or clubs whose interests focus on the academic, the political, the social, the cultural, and the sporting. Now, I just want to take one example. I want you just to imagine, you may in fact be one, a fanatical supporter of a professional football club. And we'll see just how many things he does, or she does, which are in line with Alston's list of religious activities. He may not believe in the God that is proclaimed in the local churches, but he will treat the key members of his team, and with some clubs like Manchester United, all its members, as at least demigods. Souvenir programs, especially those gained in exotic places or on occasions of great triumphs, together with other memorabilia of the club, are treated with a reverence which would seem to reflect a sense of the sacred. Club meetings will follow a certain invariable pattern, which becomes fixed and ritualistic. A ritual which is continued on the terraces as club choruses, hymns perhaps, are chanted by the devotees. Supporters will be expected to be suitably deferential in their attitude to club personnel and property, and though this is often less obvious, to behave themselves on the terraces. Or, towards the club and its history, adoration of its players, and sometimes its manager, guilt at failing to support the team on certain occasions, reflect the characteristic religious feelings mentioned in the fifth of the qualities. Prayer is expressed in the voluble support for the team when they are behind on the score during a game, prayers of exculpation when they lose, and of thanksgiving when they win, so that a liturgiologist could use their emotions as a case study. The worldview is simple and basic. Their team, this team, is the best in the land, or, if we are to refer again to Manchester United, in the world. I may be biased about that, but I would see that as an accurate reflection of reality. The genuine fan will spend virtually all his spare time either thinking or talking about the club, or attending meetings, or going to matches near and far, and would gladly sacrifice all his spare cash in the process. The club is the social organization, and the club's magazine or fanzine, together with newspaper reports about the team's doings, provide its scriptures. Thus, we find all the characteristics of a religion, some admittedly more obviously than others, in a football club. It seems that we must conclude either that Alston's list is too broadly based, or is frankly wrong, or that our view and definition of religion must be changed. It should help the inquiry if, as a working hypothesis, we could achieve, by a process of elimination, some kind of consensus as to which of the 10 features are a sine qua non, i.e. absolutely essential, a sine qua non of religion, and which can be included on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. On this basis, I think we can immediately exclude 4 of Alston's suggestions, together with the one that I added. It is not essential to distinguish between sacred and profane objects. Otherwise, to give one small but significant example, the Quakers, members of the Society of Friends, could not be described as religious. Their rejection of the sacraments of baptism and Holy Communion springs from their conviction that everything in life is, or can be, sacred, and that to state otherwise is to fall into what they call the scandal of the particular, the idea that certain things or certain people have a special hold on sacredness and that this separates them from others of their kind. For the same reason, they have no priests, believing instead in the priesthood of all believers. If no distinction is made between the sacred and the secular, it follows that there will be no ritual focused on sacred objects. The centrality of this characteristic of religion is in fact more widely rejected than the first, since there are people in abundance who assert their religious convictions without engaging themselves in any kind of related communal worship. Zen Buddhism actually warns its devotees that ritual is generally harmful to real religion, since outward observances can easily be mistaken for inner meaning or reality. And Hinduism, in its triumvirate of major obstacles to the attaining of enlightenment, moksha in their words, Hinduism includes dharma, religious rules and observances, alongside artha, which means wealth, and karma, which means desire. All these are seen as obstacles to the attaining of enlightenment, the religious rules and observances. It has been truly said, though the pun is not so effective, I'm afraid, in Sanskrit, in which the Hindu scriptures were written. But it's been said that many a man prays on his knees on the Sabbath and on his neighbours for the rest of the week. With equal confidence, I think, we can sideline 2 related characteristics: the moral code believed to be sanctioned by the gods, and the acceptance of supernaturally inspired texts, held by many to be the main source of instruction as to the code's content. There are enough thinking and concerned people in the world, and enough non-religious societies, humanist, secular, where they can share their concerns about moral and social values, to make this the most easily dispensable of all allegedly religious characteristics. Many committed members of the theistic religions say the same. There has been a book out recently by the Bishop of Edinburgh, Dr. Holloway, no less, who has argued, the book is entitled Morality Without Religion, and he simply argues that the two belong to separate areas of thought and activity. And at the heart of Taoist, that is the Chinese philosophy, Taoist moral teaching, is the admonition to be natural. Confucius, while often referring to the way of heaven, is using the phrase as a synonym for the best as we understand it. And Hinduism and Buddhism both offer their moral injunctions as guidelines rather than, as has happened with the Ten Commandments, a formal code. For the Hindus and Buddhists, their moral ideas are a piece of advice from those who are aware of the pitfalls ahead, rather than offered on a take them or suffer the consequences idea. An idea given by the Almighty, who, having made the rules up, has the absolute authority to lay the law down. The rejection of divinely inspired texts is a corollary of this perspective, and it's the theistic religions which face the tallest hurdle here. The treatment of their scriptures as the word of God has been their rock in more senses than one. A rock can, on the one hand, give a firm foundation, but on the other, it can destroy whatever and whoever founders on it. True, the Hindus have their Vedas, their ancient texts, Buddhists, their Dharmapada, Taoists, their Tao Te Ching, and Confucians, the Analects. But the authority of these classics lies not in their origin, but the length of time, and in the case of the Vedas, that means about 4,000 years, the length of time that they've proved inspirational for their readers. But to be inspirational is different from being supernaturally inspired. Otherwise, the cricketer's wisdom, or alcoholic's big book, as they call it, must be given equal status. Both these issues, the link between morals and religion, and the importance of sacred texts, are important for our inquiry, and no doubt in a later lecture we shall come back to it. But for the present, it's enough to deny that they are essential to a religion, in the sense that without them, it would cease to qualify as a religion. The characteristics outlined in the middle block of Alston's list cannot be assessed so straightforwardly. Clearly, his fifth point, the characteristic religious feelings, could be dispensed with if he had implied that they tend to be aroused only in the presence of sacred objects or during rituals, since, as I was saying, these factors are not viewed as essential to a religion. Nor should it be retained if the examples of the relevant feelings imply obedience and humility before a god, such as the theistic religions proclaim. The sense of guilt and adoration are the examples that Alston uses. However, whatever the ultimate definition of religion may be, it is unlikely to exclude the subject's feelings. It would be difficult to take seriously any person who confessed himself to be religious, but then added that he felt nothing in particular about it. Rather like the relative of a student of mine who began an essay on yoga with the words, "My aunt has no problem with her yoga. She fits it in between her sauna and her bridge." No doubt there are adherents of all the world's religions who are dispassionate to the point of being soulless when they're talking about their religion, but they're seldom likely to be more than also-rans in the religious stakes. A sense of awe, and especially mystery, seem natural concomitants in this field. It is, after all, an indication of the mysterious nature of the subject that any exploration into its meaning, such as we're doing at the moment, proves to be hard, hazardous. It seems reasonable, therefore, to retain some of Alston's characteristic feelings, the sense of awe and mystery, as essential to religion, together, I would suggest, with parallel feelings such as wonder, fascination, and perhaps ecstasy. But these should be expected without reference to specific places, objects, or events, designated as sacred as opposed to profane, which are suggested in the other half of Alston's characterization. The next characteristic presupposes a belief in the gods, or presumably God, prayer, and other form of communication with gods. As it stands, it must therefore be excluded from the list of essential features, since neither Taoism, Jainism, nor several schools of Buddhism believe in either God or gods, or if they do, pay no regard to him, her, or them. This feature could be less contentiously incorporated if we broaden the word prayer so as to include meditation and contemplation. Prayer always implies an approach to another person or being, whether this be God, another human being, or a court of justice. Prayers can be answered, ignored, or turned down. The process is two-way. Meditation, on the other hand, requires no second party. It is a deliberate turning away by the one who is meditating, turning away both physically and mentally from the daily round of duties, and engaging in the process of reflection. Unlike prayer, which can be a public, communal activity, meditation normally, at any rate, takes place in seclusion. Nowhere, wrote the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius, nowhere can man find a quieter or more untroubled retreat than in his own soul. Ah, that word again, soul. Whether meditation should be viewed as simply an exploration of oneself, as Descartes affirmed, the philosopher of the 17th century, in his first Meditation, when he described the process as holding converse only with myself, or whether it means seeking a state of absorption in something beyond oneself, the void, the ground of being, the Tao, we shall discuss when we come on to other of the world's religions. For the present, it seems sufficient to say that religion, even that of the social revolutionary or fighter for universal justice, will include times of meditation or reflection if the religious person is not to be burnt out. That, at any rate, is the counsel offered by the yin-yang philosophy, which, again, we should be looking at when we turn to look at Chinese religions. So, with another major modification to Alston's description, we retain his characteristic six, prayer and other forms of communication with gods, though we're only keeping that in a modified way. Alston's next two suggestions, the holding of a world view and the commitment of one's life to it, seem to me axiomatic, in other words, quite natural in this context. To declare oneself to be religious is to make a metaphysical statement, which is to hold a world view. For a start, the view that there is such a thing as metaphysics. Even those who are religious without being conscious of this, and I feel the world is full of such people, are likely to have pondered on the meaning of existence, even if they've concluded that, in the sense in which that issue is put, it has no meaning. Those lacking a worldview are those whose concern never extends beyond the kitchen sink or the world beneath a car bonnet. Unless, of course, they're looking at the kind of experience described in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. To such people, culture is a derisory word. The imagination is sneered at as merely an avenue of escape for loafers. The Tao Te Ching, the Chinese classic, states that there are bound to be those to whom the Tao, roughly the ground of being, to whom the Tao means nothing. If it were not so, says the Tao Te Ching, the Tao would not be the Tao. How far a person's life should be committed to his or her religion is a moot point. Alston, in this area, uses the ambiguous phrase, more or less. And we may accept that vague expression. Occasionally, one cannot be absolutely precise. It seems reasonable, doesn't it, to expect a religious person, and what that means is yet to be finally determined, of course, but it seems reasonable to expect such a person to spend a fair amount of his or her time, their energies and perhaps possessions, in religious activity. But it seems unnecessary to require more. My feeling is that this characteristic adds very little to the overall picture. So let's sum up what we've got to so far. I've suggested that the following are essential to religion. The expression of certain feelings, some form of meditation or contemplation, together with what may be termed a philosophical approach to the world and the understanding of one's place in it, and that these are likely to play more than a minor role in a religious person's existence. What must now be obvious is that the basic issue has not been mentioned. It is Alston's first and is pivotal to the theme of this lecture and indeed of this course. Belief in supernatural beings, in brackets, gods. If we are to take Alston's words at their face value, we could relegate this first mentioned characteristic from the level of a requirement to that of an optional extra. Belief in supernatural beings, or gods, to which the singular word God must clearly be added, God with a capital G, certainly plays a major role in many religions, but by no means all, and not in the thinking of some of the members of those where it does. Taoism speaks of immortals, but these are mythical figures whose longevity reflects their faithfulness to the Tao, the Way. Confucius refused to speculate on such matters, arguing that people have enough trouble coping with the problems of the here and now without speculating about those beyond this dimension in the there and then. Buddha was agnostic about the gods, refused to commit himself, suggesting that if they did exist, their condition was lower than that of those who had achieved nirvana. Another of these words we shall have to look at eventually. Jainism rejects the concept of gods altogether, replacing belief in them with the assertion that any human being, or the human soul, what they call the jiva, who reaches the highest level of spiritual achievement, experiences all that could be possibly ascribed to a god. You experience perfect knowledge, perfect satisfaction, perfect contentment. It is never possible to generalize about Hinduism, since it embraces numerous systems and writings over at least 2,000 years. But in the teaching of Advaita Vedanta, which I've mentioned already, the view is expressed that the Atman, the self, and the Brahman, the ground of being, or sustaining force of the universe, are essentially one and the same, and that the moment of enlightenment, or moksha, as they call it, is when this truth is understood. Thus, the great non-dualistic affirmation, Tat Tvam Asi, thou art that, where that is the universal and eternal spirit, or force that brought the universe into being, Tat Tvam Asi, besides being translated, as it usually is, as thou art that, can also be translated as I am that, or all this is that, or there is nothing but that. It would be far too simplistic, I suppose, and alien to Hindu thought processes to translate this statement as I am God, but in the context of Hinduism it is not so outrageous a concept as it would seem in Western religious thought, where the claim I am God would be considered presumptuous at the very least, probably megalomaniac, and its perpetrator risk being placed in a mental institution. There are books from authors who remain within the confines of the Christian religion, who retain religious beliefs, and in fact a large number of them would describe themselves as Christians, but reject the idea of and necessity for God as a feature of their religion. One of these books is entitled The Way of Transcendence, Christian Faith Without Belief in God, written by a head of theology at Glasgow University, Alistair Key. Another one, written by a lecturer in English literature at New York State University, is entitled The Gospel of Christian Atheism. And these are written by men who both look upon themselves as devout Christians. So this rejection that is made among these representatives of Christianity, together with other religions' agnosticism on the matter of God's existence, suggests that what Alston terms supernatural may not have to depend on the concept of a god or gods to justify its reality. Now, I'm going to say that again, that the supernatural may not have to depend on the concept of a god or gods to justify its reality. And once this possibility has been accepted, we are engaging ourselves in a totally different form of thought from that which evolves from the God concept. We are in fact releasing ourselves altogether from the theological perspective, theological knowledge about God, that's what theological means, one which begins with the idea of a supreme being or beings, capable of being analyzed, if not atomized, in the process of specialized discourse. And instead, we are entering into a universe of spiritual experience which is made real to us not by academic debate, the arguments for the existence of God, for example, or idealized images reflecting the perfect being or beings of our aspirations, but simply through the experiences we undergo, I'm suggesting that the first characteristic by Alston is essential to religion, but only if we exclude any reference to God or the gods. The leitmotif of what I'm saying, and that means the real thrust, if you like, of what I'm saying now, is that God, whether we call God he, she, or it, or they, that the whole lot belong on the discretionary list. But that doesn't mean that the spiritual dimension suggested by Alston's first characteristics is similarly relegated. Quite the contrary, in fact. It is difficult to conceive of a religion or of a person who describes herself as religious in which or for whom there is no spiritual dimension. I know this again, the word spiritual is another of these question-begging words which we shall return to later on. I want to introduce it into areas beyond those normally associated with religion. We'll let it stand for the moment then, and hope that you will understand what I'm getting at when I use the word spiritual. At this stage, it's enough to make two firm affirmations. First, that human experience over the millennia suggests, some might say indicates, that the world of metaphysics is a reality, not a fantasy, much less an aberration. And secondly, and this is more important, that metaphysics does not require theology, literally knowledge of God, in order to find a rationale. I think people find it, have found it, and will continue to find this experience through the arts, through music, through literature, through drama, through painting, and through nature. If you read the poems of Wordsworth, for example, it seems to me that he's describing there a religion, just as Beethoven described his final quartets as the creation of a religion, and that many people who are absorbed in the arts or in nature are in fact experiencing what can only be described as something of religion. I know that many people who still refer or defer to God when describing their religion do so without the personalized images associated with its more primitive or fundamentalist manifestations, and that they're therefore likely to describe what I've just said as already out of date. These include members of the Sea of Faith movement, founded by Don Cupid, very radical Christian, who would certainly wish to dispense with the word God, virtually in any way, case. And they are examples of those I have in mind. To people who think along such lines, I would simply put the question, if it is the case whatever they deem to be the value of religion is capable of being expressed without reference to God, are we not more likely to achieve a modicum of enlightenment in this situation if we dispense with the word altogether and speak instead of what we know to be real? The Jewish philosopher Martin Buber wrote a book, came out in 1948, I think. It was called I and Thou, and he was arguing that the great experiences of life can be described in such a way as I-Thou experiences. And he boldly stated, when you get to the thou of your life, and that could be music, could be drama, literature, could be nature, could be another person, when you get to the thou of your life, God is no more. He was perhaps unwittingly building on the Tao Te Ching, the Chinese classic, written some, roughly 2,500 years earlier, but which begins with the immortal line, the Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao, and goes on, the way that can be followed is not the eternal way. Now, what that means, we shall look at when we come on, as we shall eventually, to look at this Chinese philosophy of Taoism. what we should be doing in this course is seeing how various cultures, societies, groupings of people have expressed their religious belief. But I shall want to have as the theme running through all this the fact that many people have achieved what I am here defining as religion without being engaged in any of the external expressions of religion, which many people in the West particularly still associate with it. And perhaps a sentence that best sums up what I should be wanting to say comes from great historian, Victorian, Thomas Carlyle, when he said, "A man's religion is the chief fact with regard to him." What that means will, I hope, be explored in the further lectures on this course.